Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse. Snacky Tunes.
Hello, welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Aaron Bresnitz. It feels like summer is in full swing, and we hope that you got behind the grill or had a friend who was behind the grill this week, that you had some delicious food, shared some laughs with friends and family, and had a nice, cool, refreshing drink. We are sitting down right off of Sunset with Charles Namba and Courtney Kaplan of Tsubaki and Ototo to talk about their recent James Beard win, how they met during their time in the restaurant scene in New York, and what one can expect to hear on a Tuesday night at the bar. And then we head into the archives for a frenetic punk jubilant performance from Brooklyn's Grim Streaker. They played live for us in the Shipping Containers in Brooklyn. We thought it'd be the perfect soundtrack to keep this summer rolling. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network. Courtney and Charles, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Thank you for joining us. I know it's busy, and we're not going to bury the lead because you guys recently won James Beard for Outstanding Bar Program. How does it feel to be on the other side of that just a few weeks later?
I think we're still a little bit in shock, or at least I am. It was really unexpected, and I don't know. It was a lot to process. I think we're still kind of taking it in and trying to convince ourselves it's real. For me,
that someone's not going to knock on the door and be like, oh, we're just going to, if we could just get that certificate back.
Yeah, it was a wild feeling for sure.
For those who might be a little bit unfamiliar with that specific award, how often does a Sake Forward program win this category?
As far as I know, this is the first time. We actually won.
No, it's definitely the first time.
The category used to be Outstanding Wine Program, and then this year they changed the name to Wine and Other Beverages. So I guess we're other beverages. But yeah, this is the first time that any beverage other than wine has been included, which is feels really cool to be a part of.
Yeah, it's nice to see that they changed the name and then made good on the name change and just didn't give it to another just wine forward or wine first type of program.
Yeah, when we saw that we had been nominated, we had been nominated once before, I think in 2019 as part of for a bar program. So I was surprised to see this year when it came out as Wine and Other Beverages. But yeah, it's cool to see sake get recognition in this way. It's sort of, in my opinion, been kind of chronically misunderstood in the U.S. for a long time. So.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that in a little bit, but I want to go back a bit because you're based in L.A. And Charles, you're born and raised in L.A. Yeah. And what was it growing up in the city? What do you remember from eating as a kid? How big was food in your life with your family growing up?
Food was huge. You know, my mom, she made all types of Japanese food and American food. You know, we ate bolognese, we had ribs, rack of lamb, sort of all over the place, you know, like wrapped cabbage, and we ate out a lot. You know, it was the best part of the week was going out, you know. And once my mom, she was in real estate, once she got really, really busy, we started eating out more and more. And that was it. That experience and a lot of hamburgers and tacos, you know, pretty much.
Yes. But LA's food culture, I mean, it had its own, you know, I guess Wolfgang Puck and things like that was sort of like what you think of, or avocado toast, but it wasn't like what it was today.
Nothing. I mean, I went to one French restaurant and I didn't know what French food was. I only knew about it when I moved to New York and started working in restaurants.
And Courtney, I know that you were in New York working in restaurants as well, but before that you cut your teeth in Tokyo working at restaurants, I got to say, like, getting in to the restaurant scene through a whole different country has got to be a unique approach. How did you get in and what drew you there?
I was on a study abroad program in Tokyo, and I just part-time job in a restaurant, really, because I first just needed some cash, and also I wanted an opportunity to sort of practice Japanese in like a real Japanese environment. I was there for language primarily. It was a Hawaiian-themed barbecue restaurant. The owner was from Japan but obsessed with Hawaii, and I think they hired me because they thought having an American person on staff would somehow make their Hawaiian concept feel more authentic, although I couldn't be less Hawaiian if I tried. But it was great. I mean, the food was very simple. It was, you put a charcoal grill in the middle of everyone's table and they got raw ingredients and would grill it themselves, but it was really more of a cultural introduction for me, I'd say. Very, you know, the service was super simple. It was not, you know, like, you know, I think we think of Tokyo restaurant culture as sort of this very kind of serious thing. This was really just kind of a very casual part-time job. But no, it was a real learning experience to be working abroad and kind of exposed to that.
As a learning experience, was there anything that you picked up there that you didn't actually see in American culture, restaurant culture, when you came back, that you still practice and implement today?
You know, I worked in Japanese-run Japanese restaurants, for the majority of the beginning of my career. So it was very similar to working in Japan. My first job in the U.S. was in a sake bar where I was one of only two American staff members. So, you know, the culture, even though we were in New York, it really was sort of like living and working in Japan, because the Everything was very Japanese. I think what I took away from it the most really was the work ethic, for better or for worse. Mm. You know, restaurants are kind of grueling, demanding jobs with long hours, but I've never seen the way the work ethic in Japan and my Japanese coworkers in the U.S. Is still with me today. I think I can never live up to it, but I try to hold myself to it.
Oh, come on. Now, speaking of New York, you were both at restaurants and bars that I remember when I first started getting into food were pretty legendary. Courtney, you were at Decibel, and Charles, you were at Chanterelle, which I think Chanterelle was one of the first restaurants where I was like, there's more to food than just, I don't know, like a bodega sandwich, because it had this like such big reputation. But what brought you to New York, and what did you love about being in the restaurant and bar scene at that time?
I moved to New York kind of just running away from home. And
tales all the time.
I needed a job. Yeah. And my roommate was like, there's this Japanese restaurant that's opening up. You know, you want to cook over there? And all through high school, I worked in a pizzeria. So I enjoyed being in the kitchen more than being in the classroom, you know? So when I moved to New York, I needed a job. It felt very natural, the job. It was very similar to, how I was living in Los Angeles.
And Courtney, what brought you to New York?
I grew up on Long Island, and I went to school in the city. I was already living in New York when I went to Japan, and then I moved back to finish college. And then I just kind of ended up sticking around. I got back from Japan, I really was afraid I was going to lose the language, because if you don't use it, you lose it.
So
that's how I ended up working at Decibel, is I had been there to drink underage many times in college.
Shout out to New York.
And to Decibel for being a lawless place back then. A friend of mine was like, you know, you want a job where you can speak Japanese? Why don't you see if that sake bar would hire you? So I just called them up and asked for a job. And the manager at the time, the interview process was really just like, come down and hang out with us. And what kind of music do you like? That was a huge thing. Because whoever bartended got to choose the music.
Do you remember what you said?
I remember what he said. He was a huge fan of Todd Rundgren. I didn't have a ton of context for at the time as like a 19 or 20 year old, but I don't remember what I said, but whatever it was, we hit it off. And they ended up hiring me like totally unqualified, like knew nothing about sake. My only restaurant experience had been this like year working in this barbecue restaurant in Tokyo, but they really hired for vibes there, I think, back then. I don't know what they're doing now, but.
Oh my God. Hiring for vibes. If that doesn't really talk about the time in the New York scene, and you two actually met working at the same New York restaurant, right?
We did, at the restaurant that Charles was just referring to called N Japanese Brasserie. Someone who I knew, my former coworkers from Decibel, were asked to kind of help open the restaurant. And then they reached out to me to help as sort of like a cultural liaison for the chefs who were all coming straight from Japan with like no English and kind of their first time living abroad. So they wanted help like kind of getting the chefs situated and then for like menu translation and all that. And that's where I met Charles, because his roommate at the time was a former coworker of mine at Decibel as well, who also was the one who was like, I know this Japanese restaurant that's opening, maybe you should go try to get a job there. So we met.
The Japanese community was like very tight in New York, like all the restaurants, everybody that worked in restaurants, they knew each other and everybody knew each other. So
We'd all hang out after work or go to each other's restaurants. So in with his roommate, she suggested he come try to get a job at N, which was just about to open. So that was how we met.
Do you remember that first meeting where you're like, you seem really cool, do you want to open up a couple of restaurants in like a decade or two together? Or was it just, you're my coworker and we're going to work together?
I was actually did the interpreting for his interview with the chef. So I sat in on that and helped there. So we met way back then. We were all just kind of friends. We all hung out after work together, and Charles was living kind of in Chinatown, and he was the restaurant's in the West Village, and he was the closest apartment to the restaurant. So when we'd get off work, we'd always go all hang out at his house, or after the bar would close, go to his house.
My apartment had basically one, it wasn't even a futon. It was like a two cushion seat
I love it.
And
everybody
just sat on the floor, like Japanese, you know, drinking beers. And then it just became the spot to hang out in and stop by whenever you want and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
That time that you were there in New York was such a special time in the New York restaurant scene. What do you remember fondly about that time? What still stays with you?
It was just a lot of it was, you know, my experience at Chanterelle, really. You know, it's like from like eating good Chinese, decent pasta, Italian, to working in like a very, you know, high-end restaurant, you know, and the food was amazing. And it was my first experience tasting food like that. So it was a special time for me. Yeah.
I think also the community at that time, like it just felt so like, you know, we would get off work and it was like we would go to the same restaurants and see the same people, and you knew the bartender, and the other people from restaurants would come and see us. And it just felt like this really tight knit community. And I think maybe Charles kind of being so far away from home, like there was a real kind of family component. We all hung out on our days off all the time. Like it really, you know, every day off, it's like, what restaurant are we going to go to and see what other people are doing?
It was like, the restaurant we worked at, there was four chefs from Japan that flew in to open the restaurant and work at the restaurant.
It's incredible.
So, you know, it was every night. It's like every night. And like I was 21 and the culture is for them to pay for your meal. And they knew I was I could barely pay rent. So it was every night they liked me, so that I come out, let's drink, and we would just drink. And then everybody would show up the next day, no matter what happened, and keep working. Normal. Yeah. A lot of crazy things happened, you know?
Late like East Village, like Izakaya. I mean, we were just back in New York. I was surprised to see almost all those places are gone, but St. Mark's used to be like all Izakayas, and they all stay open late, and they let us stay extra late. Like they would close and we would stay and hang out. And yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, there's definitely... Look, New York's never going away, but there was definitely a moment in time when it was just like, you work, you go out, you eat, you're up late, and no matter what happens, you're back in.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick little break, and then I want to talk about heading out to LA and the opening of your restaurants and bar. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes, here on Heritage Radio Network.
How did this happen?
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Courtney and Charles of Tsubaki and Ototo here in Los Angeles. So you're in New York, you're grinding it out. When did LA start calling to you? Was it that era, like in the aughts, when LA was sort of getting on the map, culinary? Like, because I remember LA started like popping up a little bit with like Animal, RIP. Yeah. Recently, Pour One Out, and then like Joseph's Restaurant and like things like that. Like I started hearing more things about LA that I was like, oh, like there's something happening with restaurants out there.
I feel like the decision was more practical. I don't know. I think we had gotten the bug that we maybe wanted to open a restaurant, and it just maybe there was more opportunity in LA. At that point, it's kind of hard to believe now, but I think real estate was more reasonably priced out here. We thought we could maybe open for cheaper. We wouldn't need the same kind of financial backing that we would need.
That was
the
main reason, was it'd be cheaper.
Yeah.
You know, I remember even thinking about opening a restaurant back then was like $1 million or more.
In New York.
Yeah.
In New York.
That's
crazy. Time. Well, unless you wanted to do the Bushwick Borough thing, which was, you know, until Roberta's really did it, everyone's like, no, it's pretty much like Manhattan or bust.
Yeah. So yeah, and you know, Charles had grown up here and I had never lived anywhere outside of like the New York area except for I'm in Tokyo. So we thought like, well, we'll give it a try and like kind of see. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was just that era. We moved in 2010. So like Animal, Lazy Ox, Downtown, like all those, you know, that was kind of what everybody was talking about, I feel like.
Yeah,
that Bizarre was at the SLS.
Bizarre in the high end places, like Gordon Ramsay, Michael Mina, Sean, and then like Animal.
Yeah.
A couple of places.
Yeah.
Nothing.
I mean,
not look, relative to today, it was like name celebrity, you know, and I know it. Wolfgang Puck, not to make a joke from before, but like that's what I thought of. I was like, oh, you're just another celebrity avenue, just celebrity chef. But you come out here, and what was the food community like? Because obviously you said in the first part, New York food community was firing on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. Was there a group of people here? What restaurants did you get into? Like, how did you start to find your footing out in Los Angeles?
When I was in New York, I was planning to work at, I got offered a job at 11 Madison Park or Cafe Baloo or Bouchon or Beverly Hills. And we wanted to move to Los Angeles. And I thought that's a great restaurant. It is a great restaurant to work at, Thomas Keller for. So I moved out there to open Bouchon. And that was another part of the reason why I moved out here. The goal was to open a restaurant. But he was opening a restaurant in Beverly Hills. I was like, perfect. I'll work there in the time being.
And did you find that similar food community that you had in New York, or was it a little spread out?
No, it was. I think it was very, very small because there was just fewer restaurants. Mm-hmm. Now there's so many that, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like when we opened Bouchon, so many people came from Animal.
Sure.
Michael Mina. What's the name? Gordon Ramsay. It was small, you know, it's like think of that place, the next place.
And everybody would go to Red Medicine after work.
Red Medicine.
One of the only spots that was open late. I feel like that was the biggest challenge in LA is the driving and then everything closes early. So it was harder to find, you know, we get off work. There's not as many options here, I think, as there are in New York. But yeah, I remember going to Red Medicine or Koreatown a lot. Those were kind of the places to be, I think, post-service.
So seeing that opportunity, comparing it to New York, because New York was, you know, late and everything open, did that start to inform what your restaurant would be, saying like, okay, I see these things that we love and that we had access to in New York, but it's sort of missing from LA. Did that start to form the opinion of what your spot could eventually open to?
You know, when we were thinking about Tsubaki, which is our first restaurant, Charles just kept saying, I want this to be a place where the chefs are going to want to come. And it's really, you know, we do see that a lot. A lot of chefs do come and eat with us, which is really cool to see. Like, it's nice to be part of that community. I think, you know, we never were open particularly late, but I think what, for me at least, like what I saw was maybe we could offer sort of diversity in beverage that we were not seeing as much of out here. Like, we were coming from New York, all these like really amazing sake focused restaurants. And I feel like I wasn't seeing as much of that out here. So maybe there was room for that. And I think for Charles, it was really creating this menu that like chefs really wanted to eat on their days off. I don't know how how that came to be. It felt really organic, but.
Yeah, it's, it did. Yeah, you said it well.
So opening the spot, right off of Sunset. I mean, we can get, it's like, I don't want to confuse people because let's just call it Sunset right near Dodger Stadium for anyone who's trying to find a geographical location. Google Maps might pull you off the street a little bit, but we won't get into that. So you open up in that area, which is far removed from other sort of Japanese restaurants in the city. You know, it's not Sawtelle, you know, it's not the Valley. What was the reaction like in the neighborhood? How much education did you have to give to people for skewers? Like, what was it to open up in the community, especially since you wanted to have this like neighborhood izakaya spot?
I think the community reaction was good. There was a lot of confusion in the beginning because we actually took over for another Japanese restaurant that had been there before.
Yes, yep.
That was also a skewers concept. When we opened, we weren't doing as much. We were grill focused, but not as many skewers.
Sure,
a lot of people would come in and were very confused why we didn't have the same menu that they had. And then I think also a lot of questions about like, where's your sushi menu and what kind of ramen do you have? But for the most part, I think the neighborhood has been really supportive of us. We get a lot of people who come in and say they walk to see us. There definitely was a learning curve in the beginning. And it still happens once in a while. We get someone, oftentimes we get people from who are staying in the hotel. There's like a Super 8 motel across.
They're
very confused as to what we're serving. But at its heart, I think the food is really accessible. It's just a question of what people's expectations are when they're coming in. But
burger and a beer.
That's ototo. We're super happy, but I often when we hire new staff, I often tell them, you know, I really think I credit the survival of the restaurant to having regulars. Like, 100%. You know, when we first opened, no one knew who we were. We were not like, you know, name brands in LA or anywhere. And you know, we had people who really would come once a week and sit at the same table or the same seats at the bar. And we had 4 servers total on the roster, and they knew all the servers because they all, you know, everybody, it's the same people working every night. And I really, you know, the restaurant wouldn't have survived that first year if we hadn't had a lot of loyalty from our regulars in the neighborhood.
That's what I remember. All regulars that knew everybody working, and we were such a small team. Yeah.
We only had 30, we had 33 seats, and
it definitely feels different now.
It does feel different now, but
yeah. So much success I've found, especially in LA, is the idea of having regulars and being a neighborhood spot, because look, the press come and go, the articles come and go. It's just like, and look, you obviously just won a big award, but that's not what keeps the lights on or people come, you know, it's people coming month to month. But I've also found that, especially in LA, like real estate and like sort of like the kismet of real estate plays a big part as well of like what corner you open on, location, things like that. And I feel like so much of that is what led to Ototo. Because I remember there was a salon there, and I remember the salon there because my wife used to go to that salon. And she was like, it's closing, and I think there's like a sake bar opening or something over there. And I was like, what?
Why?
But tell me the story from how that happened, and were you always thinking about opening up a sister spot?
No, I feel like I'm just. we opened on February 2nd, and I think on like February 3rd, our landlord called and was like, "Hey, the salon next door is moving out. Do you want it?" And we were like, in a blackout state. We were like, you know, hadn't slept in weeks, and we're exhausted. And
literally the day after.
Subaki. In my memory, yes, it was within. It was
you
within.
Just said the date.
I know, for the sake of storytelling, right, but so it was within the
No, no, no. Perfect story. Sorry, go on.
It was definitely in the very first couple of weeks. But, and we just said, yes, we had like no concept. We're like, yes, why not? Sure. Like, how often does this opportunity come along? We looked for like 3 years for the Tsubaki space, and to have another space kind of fall into our lap. Like, so
that's what I'm saying. Like, that's what,
that, yeah. Yeah. And we had no ideas for it. We had thought like, maybe we'll turn it into like a lunch place and do like rice bowls. We talked about doing like a wine bar. And then I think we sort of realized like Tsubaki is very small, which is part of the appeal of it, I think, but it's also a challenge from a business perspective. And we were finding that like during peak hours, we didn't have enough room to seat as many people as we could have. And oftentimes if tables didn't turn properly, we had nowhere to have people wait, which was a problem too. And we thought, well, if we open a bar and we're running 10 minutes behind on someone's table, here's a place where they can go grab a drink. Instead of oftentimes they would go to Button Mash or something across the street and just never come back if, you know, if they were waiting.
Right. Playing pinball. I got some rice balls or something. Okay.
And then we sort of, you know, when we first opened Tsubaki, the plan was to do a sake program, really focusing on like smaller producers and smaller kind of family run craft breweries. And we were not sure how it was going to go. A lot of, I remember talking to one of my importers and he was like, you need to put some big names on your list. He's like, no one's going to order this stuff. Like no one's ever heard of these breweries. You need to make sure you're serving Kurosawa or Kikusei or Hakkaisan, which are all great breweries, but we really, you know, that wasn't the focus. But we found after we opened that people in LA were super excited about trying new things and really wanted to try things they had never had before. And I don't know, we just thought like maybe there's room for sake here. Like maybe we could do like a real concept built around sake. I think without Tsubaki, I don't know if we would have had the courage to do it, like to kind of roll the dice on it. But we saw how much people were coming in to drink sake and it was really inspiring.
Yeah, it's great. It worked out well.
Let me ask a question though, and I know you named some of the big heavy hitters in the sake world, but you also said earlier that like there's still a lot of education around sake and there hasn't been a ton of stuff like that. People coming in, how many of them even who, you know the big hitters? They're just like, oh, I hear sake and I'm coming in for an education, and I, small brewers, big brewer, new brewer, like how many people are just like, just take me under your tutelage and guide
me? A lot of people, you know, the number one thing people say when we ask, you know, can I bring you something to drink, is I don't know anything about sake. Like everyone wants to like start with that, which is totally fair. I never expect anyone to know anything. And we're, you know, we really work with our team to like, you know, how can we provide like fun education and get people excited about it. But there are people, if they have had sake, a lot of people have had, you know, Hikusi or Dasai, or they'll have a picture on their phone and they'll show us, oh, here's a sake I had at my local sushi restaurant, which is really helpful information because then we can know, oh, you like, you know, we like this style. Here's something else that you might enjoy as well. It's really good as a starting point. But there's never any time where someone's like, oh, you don't have this bottle. I don't want anything. You
know? Right. I'm out. Exactly. I'm out.
And I think some ways I've worked with wine over the course of my career too. And I find that with wine, people have pretty strong opinions about what they like and what they don't like. And it can be more challenging to get our guests to like take a risk or try something new or try something they think they don't like. Whereas with sake, oftentimes we really have a blank slate where we have kind of free reign to sort of pour whatever we want and people don't come in with as many preconceptions. There still are some in the sake world, but I find it's a lot easier to get guests to like take a risk or take a chance on something because they're not, they're more in your hands, I think.
I mean, I felt, because when I was in the other week, it felt very in your hands because even I tried stuff and I felt comfortable being like, no, this is not my vibe and you didn't make me feel, I don't know, insecure about it, even though not knowing what to order next. But the whole vibe was so inviting. Like the music was blasting. It felt very young and cool and hip and just, it's got this unique feel to it that's like coming in, we're going to take care of you. And I really like that because I don't, you know, most of the time it's like sake in so many places I felt like at times have been like an afterthought and not front and center. And to go in and get an education felt really important and really exciting.
That's great to hear. I mean, that really, we really want to make it accessible. That's kind of the, what we talk about a lot is like, how do we make it fun and accessible? Like not stuffy, not intimidating. You know, we use like all purpose glassware. Like we really try to sort of make it like an easy thing. We had talked a lot about like, can we make a sake bar that people use like a wine bar? Like nobody gets nervous going into a wine bar to order a glass of wine and a plate. No. And like, can we do the same thing with sake where there's like, take out all the intimidation, just make it like, oh, this is the bar where I'm going to meet my friend. And they happen to serve a bunch of sake there. And if you want education, we've got it. But if you don't, if you just kind of want to come and sit and have a glass of something and not think about it again, like that's totally fine too.
Now, one of the things I noticed as well is that music played a big part in the experience there. What can people expect from the soundtrack? What are you playing? I know each night sometimes has a different vibe.
So lately we've been doing J-pop every Tuesday, a lot of 90s J-pop because that's kind of my era. But trying to like, you know, bring sort of a fun Japanese theme to it. And then, you know, honestly, my staff controls the music most of the night. So whatever their feeling tends to be.
Whoever's working,
they control the Sonos. But
just like Nessel, right? Full circle, right?
You know, yeah. It keeps it fun for them. And they're a lot younger than I am. And most of them at this point are more in touch with what's going on with music. So yeah. But yeah, you know, Charles always is coming out into the dining room and saying, turn the music up. So we do play it pretty loud to, you know, make it fun.
Definitely. It's a fun place to drink and delicious food. So, you know, it's like a party.
So looking towards the future and partying and eating with you, you have the James Beard, you have these two beloved spots, your neighborhood spots. What's the future look like? What do you hope for? What do you want to see as the restaurant and the bar evolve?
It's a good question. I think for the current restaurants, I think, you know, Tsubaki now is 6 years old, 6.5 years old.
Wild.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to believe for us at least. But, you know, thinking about ways to kind of keep it updated. You know, like the menus at both restaurants are very seasonal. So we're really kind of focusing on how do we kind of push the creativity with seasonal ingredients. Mm-hmm, everything at Tsubaki is within the framework of a Japanese izakaya, but it's a pretty LA menu. A lot of other influences as well. It's not kind of dogmatically Japanese. So I think, you know, really just trying to keep it as fresh as possible. I think with Ototo, for me, really trying to do more like fun sake education. We've had a lot of brewers coming to town lately, so we're doing a lot of events with them. Like really putting a face to sake is something that I would like to try to do more of, like getting the guests to actually meet the people behind it. Like it's a labor of love to make sake. And it's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. So to actually like meet the people who create it, I think is like a really gratifying thing for a lot of our guests and for our staff too, who get super excited when they get to meet the people who make their favorite bottles. I don't know. What do you think is next for the restaurants?
For the restaurants?
Yeah.
It's just changing, you know, getting better. You know, I always feel like you can always get better. And, you know, Ototo, I feel like it's like you could have a full dinner there. And sometimes people think of it as just a bar. But you could have right now we were doing a Wagyu steak. You know, people are coming in eating Wagyu steak for two. And yeah, definitely grow, you know, do something bigger, a bigger restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I had full dinner there and drink. Right. And it was great. And learned. And Anne was telling me all about that. She's like, oh, this J-pop song. This J-pop song. Yeah. Well, listen, congratulations to you both. If people want to visit or get more information about the restaurants or see what's going on or maybe what you're pouring, where can they go?
The best place to stay in touch with what we're doing is our Instagram. So Tsubaki LA and then ototo.la because those tend to be the most updated. So yeah, I would recommend seeing what we're doing on Instagram. We tend to post all of our events and menu changes and all that stuff there.
Amazing. Well, listen, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Thanks to Anne for setting this up. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
It's so quiet in my room, I got the darkest view tonight. Looking out my window at the tears rolling down the hillside. down the hillside. Neighbors got the radio on, and it's playing a song like a single on repeat. You're stuck in my head tonight. You're stuck in my head tonight. I'm trying so hard to sing another song. I'm trying so hard, but I'm just not strong tonight. I'm just not strong tonight. Tonight, if I could turn back time, I'd do it all the same. I lost my heart, I lost my brain that first night. I fall in love so fast, it's just like a high bird flies. You are my love, and when you left, I thought I'd die at the sight of your back fade into black in the night, the night, the night. I'm trying so hard to sing another song. Strong tonight, tonight, tonight. And the day went away, I felt just like a stray, singing blue tunes in an alleyway, playing our song, playing our song, playing.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Welcome back. We have Grimstreaker live in studio. Welcome to the show, all five of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
There's what a up? Very appropriate Grim Reaper eating pizza t-shirt that is made. It's a pie till I die.
Yeah, that was.
Oh my God. So that actually might be the most relevant t-shirt in the entire 8 years that have happened. So thanks for coming. It's really great to see all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Do you want to maybe go around the room since there's a myriad of you and introduce yourselves? Shout it out.
I'm Bill. I play bass.
I'm Pial. I play drums.
Dan, I'm on guitar.
Amelia, a shriek.
Micah, guitar.
And I know the two of you from all over the years, which is always rad. So good to see you two again.
You too.
And whatever incarnation it is of music. How did you form as this amazing group of musicians?
We met on Craigslist.
As one does.
The adult personal section.
Yeah, of course. Exactly.
It's a trick question because I already knew that.
Yeah. No, we're all from various bands that sort of came together. What's your story?
Yeah, mostly through like just the local music community. Yeah. Bill and Micah were doing a music video for my other band, and then
which band was that?
Dinowaris. And then me and Pial used to play in another like kind of power pop punk band a couple years ago too. And you know, we just kind of all started throwing this together a little drunkenly, and then we grabbed Amelia.
Well, I got really jealous. I was like, I want to be in a new band. Dan was like, okay, well, you can like audition, I guess.
Did you really have to audition?
Yeah.
Kinda, yeah.
How did that go? What did you have to sing?
Oh, I nailed it.
No, obviously, because you're standing here.
It was like train of thought, just like yelling.
It wasn't like, I'm going to be performing Susie and the Banshees for you today.
No, I literally
should have made her do that.
I would be
though.
Totally into that.
Yeah, we just bonded over a love of like 70s and 80s punk, hardcore, and there's not a ton of bands in this particular scene that do this, so.
Yeah, I mean, the sound is really interesting because there's this, you know, there's the 80s stuff and then there's also the 70s that come from New York and DC and LA. How did you decide to take arguably the best elements of it and merge it together and not also while sounding like you're just kind of playing on the past?
Sure. I mean, I think it's just like having a broad spectrum of influences and just feeling like there's certain things that I'm not really seeing in like music today. The other thing too is like I'm from LA, so I started to feel like after being here a few years, like a little nostalgia for like certain parts of like just like surf and skate culture from there, but it's obviously like non-existent nowadays. So like trying to bring that back into like music or something creative that I'm doing. And then I think like each of us have like our own like specific like influence or like thing that kind of twists it just like a little bit further. And then just, I feel like just ends up being whatever it is.
Yeah.
Who were some of the bands that you brought to the table as reference points when you were writing your first round of songs?
I'd probably say like when we were just even talking about being a band, I was like, let's do something like Black Flag.
Yeah. Adolescence.
And like the Dead Kennedys.
The Dead Boys.
Yeah. And like, yeah, maybe like from the 70s stuff, like the Dead Boys for sure.
Yeah.
And then when I joined, it was like X and
yeah,
then
definitely
like
X.
The Carano kind of, yeah, like early Carano.
X-ray specs, like, slits. Yeah. Like even White Lung, like more modern stuff.
Definitely. Like a lot of.
Yeah. Like modern stuff, I feel like. I really love, like a lot of us love like A Place to Bury Strangers or like kind of bands like that. And then I definitely like from my other band have a lot of, like, and Amelia too, like shoegaze influences and stuff like that. Like, which it's not like super apparent, but I think like with a couple things we like try to like
flourishes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's always interesting when you find bands like, oh yeah, I'm into like Latin jazz.
Yeah,
the hardcore
yeah.
band, and then you're like, oh, actually, you know what, I can kind of hear that now that you say it. It's like buried super deep, but
yeah,
like the
yeah,
intentions
yeah.
and the emotions that come through that music that otherwise are not in any of the bands that reference it, that kind of come, and you can actually hear it. And definitely during soundcheck I heard so much shoegaze stuff.
Yeah
just looked at my feet the entire time.
Yeah, I mean, I have to do that.
That's
yeah.
every moment.
We want
yeah.
you to do that while also like moshing.
Yeah. yeah. Actually, that's the most difficult part is like trying to shoegaze and then like move around and like jump around like a punk band. It's impossible. This shit breaks.
You can't go too far from your pedals, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the creative constraints that we give ourselves to make new art.
Right.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
are you going to play for us first?
Our shoegaze hit, Tina's.
about a local restaurant.
Tina's is about, yeah, local diner. Damn. Local diner just around the corner from Roberta's called Tina's, which is you'll never see open unless you're out and about at like 3 a.m.
Perfect. Well, here we are with Grim Streaker live on Snacky Tunes.
Yeah.
I think most of our listeners would be surprised to know that you put out an EP this summer that was four songs and clocked in under 10 minutes. I think they would be shocked at that. How did Girl Minority come to pass? Where did you record it? What's the story?
We recorded it at a Diamond City studio with Ayad Aladami, Joel Woodmer. Two great producers and now buddies, super good buddies of ours.
Yeah, Diamond City Studios is an amazing space. We tracked live, did it in, a week?
Yeah.
And what was the writing process? I mean, you guys are not a particularly old, you're new. You're new as a group.
Yeah, definitely.
So what did the process come? Was it, I don't want to say stream of concerts, but was it written in studio? Were you prepped before? Did it kind of come together in there?
Oh, we definitely had like all of that done before. I think our first like spurt of like writing music, we wrote a lot of songs and it was just about like patience with like putting out a single, seeing like where it lands and then like trying to work on something small, like an EP. And then just like going for it.
Yeah. Songs really usually start with a riff someone brings to the table. Then Amelia just sort of figures out something to put over it and then we attach it all. And
yeah, but I think the record is pretty close to what we do live. I think that was one of the goals.
Yeah.
I mean, that's always the most disappointing thing when you see a band that just rips live and then you get their record and you go, what happened?
Yeah.
It's like,
I know.
I remember, this is not the case anymore, but when I saw The Gossip years ago, it took them like a few records to kind of figure out how to get the live sound.
I remember it sounded very like sort of processed and clean.
And then they did Movement. But I remember seeing them, I was like, bought the record. I was like, I'm so excited. And I was so disappointed. And so what do you feel that you did in there? Or what did your producers do that was able to kind of capture the live sound besides just tracking live?
I mean, Ayad's great at just like sound in general, and his energy in the studio really like encourages us to go a little crazier.
Yeah,
when I was recording vocals, I was like jumping around the room
as
I would live. So instead of having like a mic in front of me, he was like, you have to have a handheld mic. And so I had a handheld mic and was just jumping around. So it was very much like as we do live.
Yeah.
So that really helped to kind of get in the same.
He also made us play songs faster just for the hell of it. He was like, you're going to play this faster whether you like it or not.
Just for fun.
And then we'd get amped up and it would like reflect in the sound, which I thought was cool.
They also mix and produced in lab coats.
Yeah, that was...
No way.
Yeah. That was awesome.
Yeah.
How professional lab coat are we talking about here?
They look like...
Very. Like it was very scientific. Surgery.
Pristine. Yeah.
Like we're here to take a specimen.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I'll take that appendix if you don't need it.
Do they have their names on the lab coats?
That's a good question.
No, but that would be a nice Christmas present to them.
Yeah, that's like the touch.
Yeah, totally.
They should turn this off now or stop listening so we can all surprise them.
Noted.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us?
Our first single.
Oh. Do tell.
So back in January, we only had one song as a band, but we knew it was like the beginning of something.
Did you, when you wrote that first song, I mean, from time to time, bands will be like, they'll just write that first song, like, yeah, this is something. Did it come from the rift, or did it have to get all put together for you to know, or like was it from first? Was it Love at First Rift?
That one was pretty much Love at First Rift. It was totally spontaneous, actually. Like it wasn't like someone came to this like practice or something and brought it. Me, Micah, and Bill just got really drunk and then just wrote that thing,
yeah,
like randomly.
And then Amelia came in
unprepared and like wrote it.
I don't know what the words even were coming out of my mouth, and they just came out, and then that was a song.
Yeah, yeah, that was the first song we ever wrote, so that was super spontaneous.
Perfect. What's it called?
Guts.
Guts. All right, here we go. Guts, live on Snacky Tunes. You guys just put out another single called Kiss on Glassnote, which is super rad. How did that come about? And it's a really amazing comp as well for emerging NYC bands, right?
Oh my God, I love that comp. I love so many of those bands. Petite League, Your Dog, Plain Thick. Dog, yeah. Thick.
Your Dog and Plain Dog?
Yeah.
Two Dogs.
Oh, Thick.
Two Dogs. Yeah. Thick is rad.
Annie Hart, who was on right before, was like, you have to get Thick on.
Yeah,
they're awesome. Yeah, they're good friends of ours.
Oh.
Yeah, that's dope.
We'll trade emails.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. How did that come about, or how did you get approached by Glassnote for it?
A super shady Facebook message.
No way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a scam, you know? It's like you Nigerian send a, prince like, you send us one you.
Song,
yeah.
We'll give you record contract. Yeah. What was so shady about it?
I don't know. You know, most of your Facebook messages are like usually a lot of spam anyways.
Right.
So.
Also like hitting up through Facebook, like I definitely found you guys through email, and I also know you, but like email better than Facebook?
Yeah, that too. It's like it's not like we're hiding our email address. So
you actually wouldn't believe how many bands make it really difficult to get a hold of them.
Yeah.
That should not make it so difficult. As a word of advice.
Bands in nature just don't know to check
right
emails and correspondence.
Yeah, fair point. So how did it come about, and you know, was it a song that you had on hold, or did you record it specifically for the comp?
Well, I mean, we had it in our live set, but we hadn't really recorded it yet, so this was a perfect opportunity to give him something that wasn't on the EP.
Yeah, basically we were considering putting something from the EP on it, but just given like the timeline and stuff, we ended up just deciding like we wanted to put this out anyways, and it seemed like a good standalone single. So like a couple days before it was like do. We just like went into the studio one night and just like played to like 3 a.m. and like tracked it.
Yeah.
All in one. Yeah. Yep, there you go.
Perfect. And speaking of more recording, you're working on a full length that's going to come out maybe end of this year, early next year.
Definitely next year.
Definitely next year.
We're still writing.
And what's the process? Is it still just like riff, or is it like evolved from the EP, or especially, I know you work a lot of your stuff into your live sets as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, we're starting to like actually create like more cohesion around like what we're doing and make it a little bit slightly more conceptual. I mean, as you can't, like as much as you can be for a punk band.
Yeah. I think we've realized that like the post-punk thing is a good fit for us sometimes, like going between hardcore, post-punk, a little bit of like,
nothing wrong with a little melody.
Yeah. It's like find the common ground between. Yeah.
We're kind of trying to progress a little bit too with our sound. Like, even though it's obviously we only have been around for a short amount of time, but like, evolving from like that starting point we were talking about and kind of integrating some other influences too, like maybe like more post-punk stuff, like Sonic Youth and like
a song in the works that's got like a television vibe and then it gets really fast.
And also the more we write, I feel more inspired to go to other shows and to then get even further inspired by other bands that are playing and come back to the practice space and try out new things. And it's just really enjoyable being in this band.
Oh, a little love fest. I mean, it's also great just to be influenced by your peers. I mean, that was so great about the late 70s in New York City, is that they were all just watching each other and then super into each other and then trying to not beat each other or best each other, but a healthy competition.
Like, everyone was so creative and experimental. They were like, there's no limits. Let's just do what we feels right.
Yeah, we'll just make something new.
Yeah.
Like, we like that. We'll just do something else.
And then it became formulaic later on.
And then you gotta break the mold.
Yeah,
then we'll go pop.
Yeah.
Sure.
We probably will.
You have a few shows coming up too. Some of them are super exciting.
Yeah. We got a Rough Trade
Mono Gold release
on Saturday the 23rd. Then we're Bill and Dan.
Playing with the Vibrators.
Yeah, I mean, are you dying a little bit inside?
Yeah, we grew up listening to those guys. You know, teenage, like, 70s punk favorites.
Will you be on the side of the stage or in the pit?
I don't know if the Vibrators can have much
of a pit. I think they're a little too power poppy for a pit, especially for how many, I'm guessing, like, older people will be there too, but
you never know. It could be like the one night
I might throw my bra on stage.
Oh, okay. But you never know. It could be the night that like dad gets back in there.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah. Dude, if we can win over some dads who were there back in the day, mission accomplished.
Like my cousin is definitely at Riot Fest right now watching like Jawbreaker and all this stuff, and he is having his best weekend ever.
We went last year for the Misfits reunion. Yeah. He's just like, all dads.
Just got rid of the kids, went to Chicago, and is just living his best weekend. And we'll pull on that for many, many, many moons to come.
Nothing wrong with that.
I want to make sure we have one more song from your canon, if you will. But where can people find you, get the EP, hear new stuff?
You can get it on Bandcamp, grimstreaker.bandcamp.com. We have it on digital and then also on tape. There's about like, we did a limited run of like 100 and there's a little less than like 40 left. So you can grab one for like $6.
Get on it. Love Bandcamp.
Or just come to the show.
Oh, even better.
Or come find us at Roberta's in 20 minutes.
Oh yeah. Even better. Well, thank you for being on here. Big shout out to my brother out there on the West Coast. What are you going to take us out with?
A new song.
This one's good.
Babysitter. Well, thank you for listening, and we will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Yeah.
talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
Drive.